From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today we'll hear from former Alderman Michael Murphy about his decision to retire this year, plus hear reactions from his constituents. We'll examine how deportations could impact Wisconsin's dairy industry.
So they took all the employees away from dairy farms. So the dairy farms would have to sell all their cows. 90% of the cows in Wisconsin and probably in the country would go away.
Plus, we'll learn about future plans for the large rotating powwow exhibit at the Milwaukee Public Museum, a tribute to survival.
It's a way to carry on our story, to keep telling our story that's not in a museum. So people are just excited that our voice, the Native voice, will continue somehow.
All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thank you so much for joining us. Milwaukee Alderman Michael Murphy, who served the 10th Aldermanic District on the city's west side, announced earlier this year that he would not seek re-election after 35 years in office. He became the third longest-serving council member in the city's history after he left office in April. Lake Effect's Exgrit Nunez spoke to residents in Murphy's district about the retirement of their longtime alderman and to Murphy himself about his choice to retire and his plans for the future.
Alderman Michael Murphy was first elected to the council in 1989 when he was 27 years old. Before then, he served as an office aide to his predecessor, Brian Burke. In a letter to his constituents, Murphy, who's now 61 years old, said he loves his job and his decision to not run for re-election wasn't an easy one to make. Pat Miller was sad to hear about Murphy's retirement. She's a longtime resident of Martin Drive and one of Murphy's constituents.
He's the best alderman in the city of Milwaukee, which is something that I often would tell him when I ask for something and he resolves it like faster than you can blink your eye. And I don't think you get that in America or anywhere now, that sort of responsiveness and dedication that he has. But it's not just even fixing the problem, it is getting back to you to let you know how it is going to be fixed and when it is going to be fixed.
Miller says Murphy has been her alderman for all 35 years he's been in office. She first moved to Martin Drive in 1987. Aldermen can serve as powerful connectors between residents and city services, making sure broken streetlights get repaired or damaged sidewalks get rebuilt. Miller says that's what Murphy did for his constituents. Those changes might seem small, but she says they make a difference.
Truly, this neighborhood was in a lot of disrepair. And when we started the organization and started noticing specifically what needed to be fixed and asking for help to get it fixed, that is something that empowers people because there are other districts where the aldermen don't help like that. And so you get this feeling of hopelessness. But instead, we got a group of people who believed we can change things because we would constantly see that in a way we were changing things. We would see something wrong, it needed to be fixed. And with help of Michael Murphy or whatever supporting departments, we would get these things modified and changed and fixed. And that gave the people a lot of, I don't want to say power, but a lot of confidence that they had control and could make things better too, instead of just saying, they'll never do anything about that. That's just the way it is.
Another one of Murphy's constituents echoes Miller's feelings about the alderman's retirement.
I was very disappointed to hear that he was not going to be our alderman any longer because I really respect him and appreciate the work that he does.
That's Megan Kennedy. She's lived in Enderis Park for 20 years, but says she didn't reach out to Murphy until a few years ago. She says that when she began to feel unsafe about walking throughout her neighborhood, her neighbors encouraged her to tell Murphy at one of their community meetings. But it was her first time ever reaching out to a politician for help, so she was unsure how things would turn out.
I mentioned that there were a few intersections in our neighborhood that did not have any stop signs at all. I'd seen fender benders. I had seen people speeding through those intersections. And I mentioned that to him, and he said, just please follow up with an email. And I did, and he responded immediately, and he had his people go out and study the intersections. And within probably a month or 6 weeks, there were stop signs installed in four different intersections, at least in the neighborhood. It's nice to know that somebody in politics cares about your neighborhood. I think every meeting he ever had in my neighborhood, he started saying, I'm just honored to be here. I'm happy to be part of this community. And just had a lot of really positive things to say about the neighborhood and how he wanted the best for us. And that was his job, is to help our community stay and become better. And I just feel like he really worked at that.
Kennedy says she hopes Murphy will guide the next alderperson to connect with constituents as well as he did. Now we'll hear Alderman Michael Murphy reflect on his time in office and what's next for him. He begins by explaining why he decided to retire.
It was a very difficult decision, one in which when you are in public service, it's hard to give it up. And for me, it came down to that. I think it's an opportunity for some younger people to take advantage of the open seat and give them an opportunity to run for office. And also, as I've gotten older, I've decided that maybe I'd like to take a different endeavor of some areas where personal growth for my own life and family is something I would like to consider. Because public service is, if people do it the right way, is all encompassing, in which I dedicated pretty much most, if not two-thirds of my professional life and personal life the service of our community, and I would just take a little bit of a break to focus more on my family and some other personal endeavors.
What would the next chapter of your life, what could it look like? And will you still be active in the community?
Yes, I will. I mean, my parents are immigrants to this country, and one of the things they instilled into all their five children was an obligation to give back to this country. And so all of us, in one way or another, have tried to meet that goal and objective for our parents. So I'm sure I will continue doing some sort of service, whether it's as a volunteer in one or other capacity, but we plan on staying here.
Absolutely. And so you've served on a multitude of committees during your time in office. What project are you most proud of that you got off the ground?
Well, you know, in 35 years, I think I've started a lot of projects that I'm really proud of. I think certainly the Housing Trust Fund, which is an organization that provides grants and aids to low-income housing and affordable housing. So we've created nearly 2,000 units of permanent supportive housing for people generally who would be living on the streets. And so I'm proud of that. I'm proud of the MK Play Initiative, which has raised approximately $4 million in private dollars. And we just completed our 23rd park renovation in the city of Milwaukee. A lot of children in our city don't have the same opportunities as other kids, and playgrounds are an important component of their well-being. The Milwaukee Opiate Response Initiative was an important project I created a number of years ago. You know, we have a terrible problem of opiate and heroin deaths and cocaine deaths, and now fentanyl has had a terrible impact on the community. So nearly 8 years ago, created an organization to really work with our fire department social workers to provide assistance to people who have had, you know, unfortunately, overdoses. And proud to say we're nearly over 100 people now we have in treatment that, quite honestly, probably would not be alive today. The Milwaukee restaurant where you see your grading system, I created that program to help improve really not the marketability of restaurants, but really to improve food quality. So we hope that when people make a decision going to a restaurant, they look at the grading system as a factor in making a decision of staying and eating there, but also it encourages the restaurants to try and keep that grade level. And so they do a better job of keeping it clean and safe for all of us.
Right. And so I kind of want to look on the other side of things. You know, as you reflect on your nearly 35 years in office, is there anything you wish you would have accomplished or that you wish the Common Council could have accomplished during your time?
Yeah, I think, you know, I wish we had had better relationship with the state government. More recently we've been able to reach a settlement with the state as it relates to an enhanced tax base by drawing down on the sales tax. But, you know, for many years the city was frozen in terms of its shared revenue, and as a result we had to continue cutting real core services for citizens and relying just on the property tax base as a method of paying for government was a no-win situation. And so having better relations with the state, you know, it would have been helpful. I mean, the problem is we're very, you know, bifurcated state. You see elections, it's always 50-50, and unfortunately we've become it's us versus them and them versus us. And I wish we'd had better relationships. It would have been helpful for, I think, the state also, because we are their largest city and when their biggest economic engine. But we seem to always have been, you know, the poster boy to beat up. And I hope we try and change that dynamics going forward in the future years, because, you know, as Milwaukee goes, so does the state of Wisconsin. So we need to recognize that.
And so I met with a couple of residents in your district to hear their thoughts on your news of not seeking reelection. And something that would come up frequently is that it seems for an alder person to stay in that position for so long, like that seems rare, sometimes seen as a position maybe someone might stay in for a while and go on to the next higher position. What made you want to continue to be an alderman for so long?
It's a great question. I've been asked that a few times. I had the greatest job in the world. Every day I could go to work and I would be able to make a difference in improving the lives of people. I mean, that's a great opportunity and a great gift. And I would get stopped at the grocery store and commonly, and people would bring issues with me. And I always remember a story where somebody said, brought up an issue that was a federal issue. And I said, I'll be happy to help you, but it's really an area out of my jurisdiction. It's really with Congress, and you may want to check in with your congressperson. And they go, well, no, they're way too busy. That's why I'm talking to you. And I think for aldermen, we're the closest to the people.
Right.
I deal with everything from garbage collection to police services to housing. So I'm at the forefront of helping people every single day. So if you're an actively engaged alderman, you answer your own phone, you talk to citizens, you go door to door, you meet them at their businesses, you see daily what's going on in their lives. And I think, you know, there's an old saying, all politics is local. And you can't be more local than being an alderman. So I think it's a very honorable job, and I encourage people to look at politics as an honorable profession if it's done the right way.
Sure. And, each district has several neighborhoods with their own unique needs and values, like you were mentioning. How did you connect with and balance serving so many different communities?
Yeah, I have 22 distinct neighborhoods in my automatic district, and probably the most diverse in gender, age, and race. And I think that's where it gets down to is not being in your office, is going out and meeting with people. And I would do a neighborhood walk with just about every single neighborhood all every year, and going to those Black Watch meetings, going to those Black parties. I have a very big district in the context of it goes from Highway 100 to 35th Street, from I-94 to 76 and Capitol. So each neighborhood had some unique issues, whether some of it was crime or some of it was, you know, road repair. So what I tried to do is make sure that I was out in the public on a regular basis, hearing people and what their issues were.
And just to wrap up, with city elections on the horizon, what's your advice for the next person to become representative of the 10th District?
Be lucky, like me, to have a wonderful spouse and daughter who supported me, because in politics, like I say, it can be 20 hours a day. And every weekend you're working if you're doing the right way. So my advice is to recognize that serving in office is a gift and a privilege, and that you have an obligation to honor that by serving it in a manner in which you recognize it's the people's voices that count and not yours. And sometimes it's hard to tone down your own ego, but recognizing, you know, what is best for the community and putting their wishes forward.
Will you help show the ropes to the next alderman?
If they want it. You know, I've learned that I'm happy to help in any way I can, but I don't want to be one of those people telling them what to do. But if somebody reaches out, I'm going to be happy to be there.
Right. Well, Alderman Murphy, thank you so much for speaking with me today and for reflecting on your time in office with me.
It's been an honor.
Former Milwaukee Alderman Michael Murphy served the 10th Aldermanic District on Milwaukee's west side starting in 1989 and retired this year. Pat Miller and Megan Kennedy both live in the 10th Aldermanic District. They each spoke with Lake Effect's Excret Nunez earlier this year after Murphy announced he wouldn't seek re-election. President-elect Donald Trump has promised to launch the largest deportation effort in U.S. history on the first day of his administration. The loss of migrant workers could really impact one of Wisconsin's key labor industries, dairy, which relies heavily on migrant workers. John Rosenau's ancestors immigrated to western Wisconsin in the 1850s. His great-grandfather refused to speak English, and his family founded a church that held sermons in German for 60 years. He's now a dairy farmer and has hired immigrant labor primarily from Mexico since the 1990s. He explains how his region knowingly depends on immigrant labor, but will vote for people and policies that could get their workers deported. Rose now starts his conversation with Lake Effect Sam Woods with a day in the life of a dairy farmer.
My average work day now, since I'm the owner and I do a lot of sitting in the office, is different than it used to be. But it used to be you'd get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and go and milk the cows, feed them and clean them out and stuff like that. And you get done with that maybe by 9, 10 o'clock. And then after that, you do your field work or your mechanical work or anything else you had to do, like go to town. And then you'd milk the cows again at night, approximately 12 hours from when you started in the morning. That was optimum. And that was 7 days a week, holidays always. Everybody locally did the same thing. They were within 3 miles of a radius of my farm. There were 23 dairy farms. And so school had to start at a certain time because people had to get done with chores. Church had to start at a certain time because people had to be done with chores in the morning. And even football games at night had to start at 8 o'clock. So people had time to milk the cows and get to the games. And that's all changed now. I think there's maybe 3 or 4 farms within 3 miles of us now, but the same number of cows.
Well, I can imagine with less farms but the same number of cows that hired labor is more important now for dairy farmers than it was, say, a generation ago.
Absolutely. Probably 20, 25 years ago, things changed dramatically, and there got to be more cows on farms. And that was an economic thing because people, like when I started farming over 50 years ago, the margin was 50%. So if you took in $100,000, you had $50,000 profit. Back 50 years ago, you didn't have that much income, but it still was 50%. Now we're on a good year, you're probably getting an 8% margin. So you have to have a lot more animals and a lot more volume in order to make a living nowadays. And so that has changed a lot. And because of that, you'd either have to have 12, 15 kids or you have to hire people to work for you.
Donald Trump has built a campaign around mass deportation of undocumented immigrants. How could the loss of undocumented immigrants affect dairy farming and all of the industries that directly rely on dairy farming? I'm thinking meat packing, canning, cheese processing. How would these industries be affected by this loss of labor?
Doing step by step. So they took all the employees away from dairy farms. So the dairy farms would have to sell all their cows. So 90% of the cows in Wisconsin and probably in the country would go away. They would go to packing plants. Packing plants are staffed by immigrants. They're the ones that would have to kill the cows and make it into meat. And the market would be flooded with meat, but there wouldn't be any milk or dairy products or cheese or butter or ice cream to buy. That would go away from our diet. Then once all that meat was consumed, that would go away. And all you'd be able to eat basically is corn and beans and some vegetables.
Keeping on the theme of if mass deportations, if Trump's promise of a mass deportation comes true, what effect would the loss of these people mean for your community more generally?
Well, Ashley Furniture would have to shut down. So all the people that work there, and I think there's 5,000, I don't know how many are immigrants. They would most likely have to find a different job if they could. Pilgrim's Pride, a chicken processing plant would have to shut down and they would have to find different work. All the farms that are integrated through Pilgrim's Pride with chicken coops that rely on pilgrims to make the mortgage and stuff like that would probably lose their farms. The school would be decimated. And so there would only be 25% or 20% of the number of people living there now. The other part is that a lot of the people, kids in school, are citizens. So if you deport their parents and leave the citizens here that are 10 years old or 8 years old, how are they going to survive? And so they would have to follow their parents home, and they're citizens.
In your experience, have you noticed differences in immigration enforcement under Democratic versus Republican presidents?
No. That's the simple answer. There's no. I know of one farm in the last 10 years that they came and checked documents, and he is still farming today, and he's got his documents in order now, but he was really concerned and it cost him quite a bit of money and he almost lost the farm because of it. But I know a lot of people, a lot of farmers, and that's the only one that I know of.
So without seeing differences in immigration enforcement in your region between Democratic and Republican presidents, including Trump, why would someone who hires undocumented labor or depends on an industry that depends on undocumented labor support mass deportations now?
What I've been told by those people is that he doesn't really mean that. Back in 2016 or 20, whenever it was that he was running, he was saying that day one he's going to deport everybody. There was somebody in California that was a big Trump supporter, and he had the dairy farmer. So we called him up and we asked him, you know, why are you saying that you support Trump and he's going to take all your employees away? Oh, he said Trump assured him that he didn't mean me. And so I would assume that's what people think. But all we can do is go on history. And so he became president. He had the power to do whatever he wanted to, I guess. And he didn't do it. What we found at that point was that our employees became very concerned. And a lot of the people working here left, went home to Mexico. And dairy farmers were running about four or five people short. And everybody else had to pick up the slack and everybody was working all the time. And then after about 7 or 8 months, everybody's came back because they knew that he wasn't going to do what he said he was going to do. And nothing changed. So I think based on that, we can assume the same thing now.
So if I can paraphrase and let me know if this is the correct characterization of what you're saying, is that from your perspective, the calls for mass deportation now, it's about fear as much as it is about policy. So the fear that undocumented people, we're going to come after you, so you better self-deport now.
A lot of people have no interaction with immigrants. And so they rely, their opinions are based off of somebody else's opinion. And so they listen to somebody else that badmouths immigrants, and they believe that. And because they haven't taken the time to really get to know an immigrant or study the thing, because you're busy and you have a lot of things that you want to do in life, and you don't have time to study everything. So some issues don't touch you very much, so you don't worry about it. And one of them is immigration. A person in town or something, or somebody out in the country that never sees an immigrant but watches TV, and they have to have an opinion, so they listen to somebody on TV or somebody in online or whatever talk about immigration, and they base their opinions on that.
John Rose now is a dairy farmer and owner of Rosenholm Dairy and Cow's Moe Compost in Cochrane, Wisconsin. He spoke with Lake Effect Sam Woods for a special we did back in October on immigration. In about 10 minutes, we'll learn what makes the Milwaukee Public Museum exhibit A Tribute to Survival so unique and what it still has to offer. But first, students react to DEI cuts in the UW system. Keep listening to Lake Effect on WUWM. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Last December, the UW System Board of Regents accepted a deal to make changes to its DEI programs in exchange for funding for employee pay raises. UW System President Jay Rothman negotiated the deal with Republican Assembly Speaker Robin Voss. Voss has previously held up the $800 million in the UW System funding for months, over concern that universities put too much focus on DEI, which stands for diversity, equity, and inclusion. The deal froze hiring for DEI positions for 3 years and required that the UW system restructure a third of DEI jobs to focus on success for all students. Lake Effect's Excret Nunez spoke to UW-Milwaukee students early in the year to get their reaction to the deal and what DEI programs actually look like on campus.
At schools like UWM, DEI programs support a broad range of students who are underrepresented in higher education. That includes veterans, students with disabilities, LGBTQ+ students, and students of color. But Republican lawmakers, such as Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, see DEI as racially divisive and part of left-wing indoctrination.
That's really what DEI is. For people on the left, it's become their new religion. They no longer go to church on Sunday, but boy, are they trying to make sure that everybody is evangelized to on campus, that there's only one acceptable viewpoint.
After Voss and the UW system reached the deal to restructure some DEI jobs, Voss promised it was a first step to eliminate DEI initiatives throughout the state. The targeting of DEI programs is especially concerning for students of color. Victor Chavez is a junior at UWM. He says he frequently visits the school's cultural centers, including the Roberto Hernandez Center and the Black Student Cultural Center. The centers provide academic and social support for underrepresented students. Chavez describes his reaction to the UW deal targeting DEI.
When I did find out that it was approved, it did hurt me a little bit just because, you know, I frequent the Roberto Hernandez Center and the Black Student Culture Center, but all these culture centers are so important to students because a lot of them are a place for, not even just for culture, but just for, like, similar backgrounds. And for a lot of us, it's like the third place for our daily routine. If you don't know what that is, third place is like, okay, you have school, work, you have home where you relax, and your third place where you can socialize. And for us, it's this place. And it's such an amazing place that I'm so lucky that I get to experience it. And I hate to think that years after, when all of us are gone and we still do our best to support this place, that it's not going to be enough and there are kids in the future who are not going to be able to experience like what we've been able to experience.
Another student who didn't want to share her name says UWM's cultural centers have been a highlight of her college experience. She says one major reason she transferred from UW Oshkosh to UW Milwaukee is because of the support UWM offers to students of color like herself. If Voss follows through on his promise to get rid of more DEI initiatives, she says she worries about how that would impact diversity-based scholarships.
I am barely going to be able to pay for this semester, and like we talked about before, I know I'm not the only one that might not be able to continue their education if this change actually like takes place and like a lot of scholarships and grants and opportunities are taken away from us. And I think that's going to lead to where we were before, just the same people getting the same privileges and the same people who are not going to have a voice.
Another student I spoke with is a freshman and veteran. He didn't want to share his name because of the controversy surrounding the DEI issue. He says he frequently visits the Black Student Cultural Center and the Military and Veterans Resource Center at UWM. He says the Black Student Cultural Center helped him find community on the predominantly white campus.
I've been in areas where African Americans have been the majority and whites have been the minority. And it wasn't until then where they understood the power and inclusion and, you know, everybody having their own personal areas. But when you are the majority, especially in America, it's so easy to look over the needs of others. People don't see it as a big deal, but when you go through backhanded racism, when you're in a group project and you're the only Black kid and you feel like you're being mistreated by your partners, and not only is this a place to where we can come, we can speak to advisors to fix situations like that, but we can also come and get away. I don't know. It is very disappointing, but I'm not surprised, because it's really just another day being a minority, and people will never get it, but it's really just another day. It's really just one more thing we can't have. It's one more thing they have to take away.
It's unclear what DEI jobs and what programs will change under the legislative deal. In a statement to WUWM, UW System spokesman Mark Pitch says campuses have until 2026 to restructure DEI positions. UW System President Jay Rothman has also said no employees will lose their jobs under the deal and that he's committed to upholding diversity efforts. When we reached out to Speaker Voss for a comment on this story, his team directed us to a December 8th statement, which says in part, "Our caucus objective has always been aimed at dismantling the bureaucracy and division related to DEI and reprioritizing our universities toward an emphasis on what matters, student success and achievement." Victor Chavez, the junior at UWM, says he worries about what the school might look like in years to come.
I would be proud of the work that I've done here, but I wouldn't be proud of what it becomes if the restructuring, which I think the restructuring basically means less resources available. Like, I've helped paint these walls. Like, I've helped choose out decorations. Like, I've really helped to make sure that this space is welcoming to a lot of people along with my other friends. And if I come back in like 10 years and this is like three offices and like, I don't know, a bunch of empty chairs and boxes for storage, it's going to break my heart, because it's just like all these great memories and all the great effort we put into this was just like, it was just for us and nobody else. And I don't know, that feels like very selfish and like such a definitive end to something that I feel like should last as long as this university is open.
Chavez also says he thinks scaling back DEI programs will only hurt UW schools more as they struggle to increase enrollment and funding.
That was Lake Effects expert Nunez speaking with three students at UW-Milwaukee who all use the school's cultural centers. They shared their thoughts about the DEI restructuring deal the UW System Board of Regents approved last December. As a note to listeners, WUWM employees are affected by the pay raise referred to in this report. We'll take one more break and then learn why a popular powwow exhibit won't make the move to the new Milwaukee Public Museum location. We'll learn what's going to happen to it next on Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. One of Milwaukee Public Museum's best-known exhibits is A Tribute to Survival, which opened in the fall of 1993. The centerpiece of this exhibit is a giant turntable that rotates 37 life-size figures that recreate a powwow grand entry. With the museum scheduled to move to a new site in 2027, many questioned what would happen to this exhibit, especially the people who helped create it. When Carol and Diane Amore discovered that the Tribute to Survival exhibit did not make it into the plans to move to the new museum location, they started an effort to work with the museum to make sure the exhibit could have a future to continue to teach new generations. Carol and Diane join me to share more about their plans for the exhibit moving forward. Carol begins by sharing her initial reaction to learning about the museum's plan to move.
I was very saddened, probably horrified, because we had said initially that this was an exhibit, a forever exhibit, that was being built to pay tribute to the tribes of Wisconsin and to the Native people of Wisconsin. And it still has so much to teach, and so many of those models are still here with us. And so, you know, why should that tribute stop? It's still very important, and we still have so many things to learn from it. So that's pretty much how I felt.
How about for you, Diane?
My first reaction was a question: is the exhibit going to move with the museum? And then as we learned more and we found that it was not going to move, they started asking questions about what should happen to the exhibit itself, to the figures. And then I started to worry about, like, well, where are they going to go? Are they going to put them in storage, or are they going to break them up, or what was going to happen? So mine were basic questions, and then we started a dialogue with the museum.
So before we get into that dialogue with the museum about the future plans for the Tribute to Survival exhibit, I want to go into how this exhibit was made and curated by the whole community and what makes it unique. So typically, museums have historians, anthropologists putting their exhibits together, but how was Tribute to Survival unique in how it was made?
Well, there are a lot of ways that it was unique, but probably one of the biggest was that from the get-go, once we started working on the exhibit, the museum, and I say we because at that time I was an employee of the museum, but we reached out to the Native community in Milwaukee with the idea of inviting as much participation as possible in terms of how things were said and how the exhibits looked and who should be the models and how we should go about reaching out. So at that time, that was pretty unusual because that was back in the late 80s. The exhibit had really been inspired by Indian Summer in Milwaukee. And I think that's kind of what got museum people talking about it first and looking for grants. And they got a very big grant to do the exhibit. So immediately started reaching out. And that was very unique.
So from the get-go, a whole collaborative process with hundreds of tribal members across Wisconsin. And for you, Diane, you were involved in the beginning as well. Do you recall what that first meeting or the first initial meetings were like with the Milwaukee Public Museum about 35 years ago?
I do. One of the people who came was Nancy Lurie, who is an anthropologist from the museum, and she had a relationship with some community members already because she taught classes at the university and was involved with Native community throughout the years. So when she first came, I have to say that we were kind of worried, like, why are we going to help a museum? You know?
Yeah, speculation, like, right, like trepidation.
Right,
yeah.
Because like as you said, anthropologists and historians set things up from their point of view. And so in this case, they came and asked for us to be at the table right away and that we would have a voice in how it would proceed. So in choosing the models, for instance, we decided to try to choose people who look different, not look like an Indian looks, and also that there be representation from the different tribes in Wisconsin.
And these were real people that were used for the models, which I think is so cool. I did not know that before this. I've gone to the museum all these years, and I think that attention to detail is so great and unique. And there's also some other things that were priorities for the group making a tribute to survival. So can you share some of the other behind-the-scenes production that went into this that, you know, the day-to-day visitor might not think of and know?
I think of very important story or interesting story is the first time we had what then was called a general council at the museum. And there were several planned, and anyone from the Native community in the state was invited to come and have a say, have a voice in how we were proceeding. And the plan had been that the figures were going to be behind glass on that turntable, that it was going to be totally glass enclosed. Well, right away you think that's like museums. Everything is put behind glass. And then immediately that makes it look like from the past. You know, it makes it look like it's not going forward or there, you know, it's not alive and well here right now. Outfits from the museum's collection were going to be used. And that was one of the reasons that it was going to be behind glass. So anyway, we had the first general council meeting, and there was an opportunity for people to speak. And one of the first people from the Native community that stood up to speak said, "Why are you going to put us behind glass? You said you want to do an exhibit that shows that we're still here and that our culture is alive and thriving and has survived all of these government efforts to make us assimilate. So you want to put us behind glass?" And then person after person, you know, said that. And the conservators, of course, expressed great concern, saying it couldn't be out in the air because you have to protect the outfits and so forth. Well, at that point, which I just think is a real exciting moment in the story, the head of exhibits and design stood up and said, "Well, I have an idea for this. We won't use the outfits from the collection. We'll have all the outfits made by Native people in the state. So then it doesn't have to be behind glass." And there was, you know, a lot of discussion about that. And then that's what happened. Oh, and then the other thing he said was, "And Caroline will gather all the outfits." So, which turned out to be great,
yeah,
because I got to travel all over the state and meet people from all the tribes. It was, what an opportunity, you know, what an honor.
As you mentioned, it was an open call to action to invite everyone in to have input. And one major group that plays a factor in this project and beyond is the American Indian Advisory Council in Milwaukee. So, Diane, can you speak to what their goal was during the time in the late 80s when they were involved in this process as well?
We decided to form a group because many things were happening in Milwaukee, like construction and different things, and we were never at the table. We were never invited. And in fact, our population is so small, we're always statistically insignificant. So we're small, and so lots of times people don't even recognize that we're here. And one of our goals was to be more visible in the community. So therefore, when they came, we thought this was an opportune time, a win-win situation for us. But then again, that concern about, you know, museums. So after a discussion, we decided that we would endorse that and therefore it could go forward. And so a lot of, like I said, the figures, the models were chosen by people from this area and people who lived in this area.
So as you both have been hitting upon, the importance of a tribute to survival and its legacy its roots, but also its longevity is still needed today, especially for the educational value for people both in the Milwaukee area and beyond. So with the plans for the museum closing this location and moving to a new one and not taking this exhibit intact with it, what are the plans to make sure that A Tribute to Survival is not simply moved? What's happening now? What are you working on?
Well, after Diane and I talked with Katie Sanders at the museum, and a shout out to her, she really has been cooperative and supportive. And once she kind of understood some of the things we were looking at doing, has been more than helpful. We've worked with the museum, and they've signed an agreement with us, with our tribute documentary group, so that we can produce a documentary about the making of Tribute. And we're hard at work on that already. We're starting, you know, to fundraise so that we can do this. And what's terrific is that from that beginning and that signing off of the museum in December, they've now created a working group at the museum to help us. We've also talked about, after we finish the documentary, that we'll do like a virtual tour so that kids in schools or, you know, anyone can continue to tour that exhibit. But then finally, when it's time for the exhibit to move, that for those figures that don't go someplace else, and maybe you could talk about that a little bit, Diane, that they will share with us the rest of the exhibit so that we can find a new home for it. That'll be the next step. But the idea, again, would be that those stories could continue to be told, and it could even become beyond tribute. So we would add in stories from all the tribes about all the things that have been done in the last 35 years and will be done in the next 100. So pretty exciting, the possibilities. But maybe you want to talk a little bit about, Diane, the figures, how that's going to work.
Yeah. Some of the figures are of people who have walked on. And some of those families don't want their relative to be there anymore. And some people are going to actually take their own figures if they can, if they let them. But like, for instance, one person I know, the female veteran in the exhibit, she's asked that her figure goes to the Veteran Historical Society Museum, and they've accepted that offer. There's a couple of the figures that the museum wants to use and repurpose within their collections. So different things will happen with them, but as Carol said, we wanted to keep using them to tell stories, to show progress within our communities.
Yeah, so much more to build on, mm-hmm. as you're saying. So with the start of this exhibit being a collaboration, and now with this new phase of the exhibit also being collaborative, despite the fact that it's ending at the museum as we know it now, what are you looking forward to for its future?
There's a couple things. One of the things is that this group that we talk about, the Tribute Documentary Group, there's so many people who have signed on to be part of it in different ways. Some people are really involved in, like, you know, fundraising or decision making. That's one of the things. The other thing is it's a way to carry on our story, to keep telling our story that's not in a museum. So people are just excited that our voice, the Native voice, will continue somehow.
Keying off of that, I think that fact, to see how people are coming together. Mm-hmm. And also you had asked about, you know, our titles, and that we're really trying to do this in an Indigenous way as well. You know, we have different groups because some are focusing more on fundraising and some are focusing on, you know, other things. But that, you know, it's consensus. We all have a voice and we all work together. And it's also very exciting to bring it into, you know, life today and looking forward, mm-hmm. so that it's not just being, you know, held at a certain moment in time. And then to look at all those questions about, you know, what is the role of museums, or what should the role of museums be? And that question of who gets to tell the story? And to a certain extent, lesser extent probably, you know, what is, should be, or could be the role of allies? And how can this be a teaching tool? You know, and how can it be something not just for today, not just for the past, but, you know, for years and years to come, you know, looking out to the seventh generation.
Well, Carol and Diane, I want to thank you both so much for joining me today and sharing the great, exciting plans that Tribute to Survival will have. And I look forward to more updates and more conversations in the future as you continue to work on this.
Miigwech, thank you.
Miigwech.
Carol Amore was the script writer for A Tribute to Survival and is the administrative assistant for the Tribute Documentary Group. Diane Amore is a member of the Prairie Band Potawatomi Tribe and a member of the Tribute Documentary Group as well. You can find out more information about the project at WUWM.com. And that wraps up today's show. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. If you've missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, you can download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll hear the story of Guerrilla Gay Bar. It's when a group of LGBTQ+ people took over traditionally straight bars in Milwaukee. Plus, we'll tell you about a group of LGBTQ people from Milwaukee who took Hollywood by storm in the 1970s. Thank you so much for joining us today, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.